Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Meet the Professor. It's the day we talk about the management of Hodgkin and non-Hodgkin lymphoma with Dr. Ian Flynn from the Sarah Cannon Research Institute and the Tennessee Oncology in Nashville, Tennessee. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room. We'll talk about as many of those as we have time. As always, we have a quick one-minute survey for you to take at the beginning of the meeting and another one at the end. If you could do that, you'll get a lot more out of this meeting. We'll learn a little bit about you. We do webinars all the time. On June the 28th, we've got a big one coming up on the management of endometrial cancer following the SGO meeting, where two huge first-line trials were presented, phase three trials. We'll talk about how that's going to affect our practice. And then on July the 6th, we'll continue our ONS follow-up series with a program on chronic lymphocytic leukemia. We know a lot of people end up listening to our webinars. If you're into podcasts, check out our Oncology Today series, including a program we did on lymphomas based on the last ASH meeting. But today we're here to talk about Hodgkin and non-Hodgkin lymphoma. And as always, we have a bunch of docs from a community-based practice, general medical oncologists. We're going to be presenting cases today. Here's where we're heading. We're going to start out talking about, of course, one of the biggest stories in oncology, Hodgkin lymphoma. And then we'll move on to the others. We have time. We'll get into some papers that Dr. Flynn has done. So before we get started, just kind of curious if you have any overall impressions coming out of ASCO and, of course, EHA, particularly about Hodgkin. We're about to hear a couple cases of Hodgkin's. Any preliminary thoughts before we get into the cases about the big SWOG paper that was presented there?
I mean, I thought that was fantastic. The plenary session, that just practice-changing data. And I've already incorporated into my practice and starting a new patient out this week on the new regimen with Nevo plus ABD. So yeah, I think it was great data. That's really going to change the way we take care of patients with Hodgkin.
So we'll take a look at that in a second, but I want to start jumping right into how this might potentially apply to practice. I want to start out with a case, and I'll tell you, I just heard this case a couple days ago, and it absolutely blew my mind. I was like stunned by this case. And it wasn't so much the Hodgkin story, but you'll hear this in a second. Anyhow, 37-year-old man, well-controlled HIV. You're going to hear the story. This patient ended up getting presented with I think what was the standard of care before at ASCO, BV plus AVD. But there's another aspect to this case that is really interesting. Here's Dr. Morgenstein.
37-year-old gentleman presented with a large supraclavicular mass, asymptomatic, and he'd noticed it for, you know, quite a while, probably at least 6 months. Was biopsied and found to be classic Hodgkin's lymphoma. His PET scan showed disease above and below the diaphragm. And then he got sick. Like, he got sick on a dime. I mean, he started all of a sudden to develop night sweats, rapid weight loss, high fevers, severe cytopenias. When we treated him for his first dose of chemotherapy, his ANC was 0.16. And talk about having to really push your nurses into treating somebody, that was difficult. He had a brief hospitalization. Even I couldn't take it anymore, so I had to hospitalize him. But subsequently responded beautifully. Sweats went away. Lymphadenopathy rapidly diminished. Interim PET scan was negative, and he's currently finishing cycle 5, tolerating very minimal neuropathies, but otherwise tolerating it great. So my question is now, with data that just came out, what is the best first-line treatment for a patient with Hodgkin's?
How long ago was he diagnosed with HIV?
He was born with it.
Born with it?
Yep.
Wow. 37 years old, born with HIV, and still doing well. Before we get into the Hodgkin, have you ever seen that or heard of it?
I have not. That is really tells you how the times have changed and how far we've come with HIV care. But, you know, that's amazing.
Yeah, when I heard it, too, I was thinking 37 years, you know, I was starting to think about, like, CML and, you know, whether or not other parts of oncology will ever become, like, you know, that. Any thoughts also about treating patients in general with cancer who have well-controlled HIV, and particularly Hodgkin, also the impact of transplant on these patients, particularly allogeneic?
Yeah, I mean, I think in general, we just treat them like they don't have HIV, especially, you know, definitely if they're well-controlled and have undetectable viral load, I would treat them just as we would anybody else. I certainly remember the days in the early days of the HIV era when that was not true and you had to cut the doses of chemotherapy down and patients weren't well controlled and the morbidity and mortality was quite high with these regimens. But nowadays, the new regimens, I would treat them just as any other patient. From a transplant standpoint, I mean, again, if this patient relapsed, he would certainly be a candidate for an autologous transplant. And just as anybody else would, and we've certainly done that, and that has not been any problem. Not really sure I would know. In this case, I don't think I would go to an allo for sure, but I'm not sure how an allogeneic transplant would affect things. Of course, you have all the immunosuppressant associated with that as well, which might be a little bit more problematic.
I think there have been cases where the HIV went away after allogen. That's kind of what I was wondering, whether that, I mean, obviously with Hodgkin, he's not going to get that. But anyhow, any other thoughts about this case? Also how he deteriorated so rapidly in the neutropenia. Any thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, it does happen, right? So people are well and then suddenly they're not well and they drop their counts. I mean, it is nerve-wracking, right, when someone has no neutrophils and you're giving the chemotherapy, but you have to realize that's the only way forward to get this person out of that. And that's exactly what the doctor did, and it sounds like he had a great response and very successful approach.
So before we take a look at the ASCO data, I want you to take a look at another case because this patient actually was on the SWOG study. And actually, this interview I did was only a few months ago, so I guess it was before the trial broke and, you know, they knew that it was positive. But he got randomized to AAVD. You'll hear what happened to him. And one of the things I'm curious about is, first of all, if you saw him again, would you want to use the new regimen with the Nevo, because he had a lot of lung disease and pulmonary symptoms. But anyhow, just take a listen to the case first.
61-year-old man who presented with history of low-grade fever, significant weight loss, and worsening shortness of breath is what brought him to the hospital. And when the CAT scan was done, he had a left lower lobe lung mass with hilar adenopathy, left-sided pleural effusion, some atelectasis, and extensive adenopathy both above and below the diaphragm. So we did biopsy from the left supraclavicular lymph node, which confirmed that he had a classical Hodgkin's lymphoma. He had underwent a bronchoscopy. He's a never smoker, but I had to confirm that this was only one disease. He had an endobronchial lesion in the left upper lobe bronchus, and pathology was consistent with Hodgkin's lymphoma. So we put him on the SWOG trial, the 1826. This patient got randomized to AVD rituximab vedotin. So he has so far received the first cycle of AVD-BV. So my questions are, any role of interim PET scan on these newer regimens? What would you do if on an interim PET, which I plan to do after two cycles, if he had still residual PET positive disease, would we change any treatment? Would we just continue and complete six cycles and then repeat the PET scan?
So any thoughts about the case and her last question there about interim PET scan also? I mean, I don't think she can do that with the trial, but I think she was saying theoretically, what would she do?
Right. I mean, I still get interim PET scans on these patients, especially with the AAVD regimen. We know from the trial that led to its approval that that if you look at it, say someone's PET2 positive, should you switch them and do something like BioCop? Well, I don't think so. The results are almost the same, even though in that patient population, as if you had switched. And of course, you don't get all the second malignancies and all the other toxicities that you get with BioCop. So I do it. You can say, why would you do it? But I think it's always reassuring to the patient and as well as yourself about how close you have to follow things to know that they're PET2 negative. I think the big question that comes up is with a new regimen, with the Nevo AVD regimen, you know, with the inflammatory issues that can occur, are there going to be false positive PET scans? And I think there you might, there I might not want to do it, or at least if I did it, I would interpret it with caution. We're going to know a lot more, I think, when the final data set comes out, when the publication comes out, and we can wade through the details of that trial. But right now, I'm still doing that, doing the PET2, mostly for prognosis.
Any concerns about using a checkpoint inhibitor? I mean, of course, it's very unlikely he's going to get pneumonitis, but you know, he's already short of breath, a lot of disease in the lung. Any concerns about that?
I mean, I think that's a valid point for sure. But personally, I would pressed on just and it seems like the trial allowed this patient to still go on. So they thought that it was equal to that patient could have been randomized to either arm of the trial. And so I would have used that regimen in this patient. I guess I don't really normally think of the pneumonitis as occurring so quickly, and maybe it can, but I tend to think of it happening after a few cycles. And by that time, they probably would have already had cleaned up the disease priority were responding and symptomatically better.
That's a good point. So Rosanna, and then we're going to look at the data in a second, but Rosanna in the chat room wants to know, who would you not offer Nevo AVD to? And I guess, you know, one issue that comes up in general with checkpoint inhibitors is people with prior autoimmune disease. I don't know if there are any Hodgkin situations where you wouldn't want to use it, but any thoughts about where you wouldn't want to use it?
Yeah, I think that's a great point that the autoimmune disorders might be a contraindication. I mean, my guess is the eligibility criteria for this trial probably excluded some of those patients. I'm trying to think of, is there a patient that I wouldn't use this regimen for? I mean, I would only use it, of course, in those advanced stage patients that met the eligibility criteria for this. But I can't think of a subgroup of patients that I wouldn't give this to.
So let's take a look at some of the data. And I got to say, I mean, I knew this study was out there and I didn't really think about it too much in terms of until we saw the data. But I was kind of disappointed. There wasn't, I mean, I know it's hard to pull off studies like this. It was a cooperative group study and not industry. But I was disappointed there wasn't a trial that had both Nevo and BV in it. And we'll talk about the fact that there's some data earlier, non-randomized data with that strategy. But, you know, we're about to switch from, we just picked up this new therapy. Now we're about to, I guess, leave it. I don't know. But in any event, pretty straightforward randomization. And even though, you know, at this point, follow-up, not that many relapses, but still hazard rate of 0.48. So, and I guess when you think about it, I guess Hodgkin's is one of the most sensitive diseases. It has this amplification and sensitivity to checkpoint inhibitors. Any thoughts about that biology?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's a disease that's exquisitely sensitive. We also, primary mediastinal B-cell lymphomas are also sensitive to it. I mean, one of the criticisms about this trial is that, you know, it's just, people say, quote, just a progression-free survival advantage and not an overall survival advantage. Well, they also said that about the Echelon 1 trial with BV versus ABD versus ABVD. And it just takes a while for that to mature out and see the survival advantage. But even if there wasn't, you're saving 6 to 7% of patients a relapse, and the adverse event profile is not worse with this. You're trading some immune events for and not having as many, but you're getting not as many of the peripheral neuropathy events. So, you know, to me, this seems like a very easily adoptable approach for patients and a huge advantage.
So we'll see what happens. And here are some of the data. You actually were involved with this study. I guess there's a bunch of arms to this. We just actually, here's the thinking in terms of, you know, the idea of an antibody-drug conjugate plus PD-1 makes a lot of sense, because if you think about it, we know chemo plus PD-1, you know, use it all the time in lung cancer, et cetera, et cetera. But again, just this week at the lymphoma, this is a press release that came out in the past, but just this week in Switzerland, the ICML, they literally had this poster out there with BV, Nevo, doxorubicin, dacarbazine, and this is the data they just presented in the last day or so, I guess a poster. 94% response rate. Any thoughts about that? You think this is where we're going to land in a few years?
I think it very well could be. I mean, the the discussion at the plenary session at ASCO was a lot around this, in the sense that it's not that BV is a bad drug. It's a great drug. It dramatically improved things for patients with Hodgkin's disease. Now the challenge is how to use them both, and maybe we can get rid of some of the other drugs, such as vinblastine, which is neurotoxic and overlapping toxicity with BV, with brentuximab vedotin. So trying to get rid of some of the other chemotherapy, incorporate these novel agents, I really think this is the way we're probably going to be going.
Of course, it would be helpful if we had better predictors of response. You know, BV, that seems like there's some patients who do really well with BV. Even, you know, relapse disease, you can see some of these people do well for it. Have you seen that happen?
With relapse and do well with BV, is that what you're asking?
Yeah, just BV alone, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I have seen that. I've seen that in, there's a rare form of transformation, Richter's transformation, CLL with Hodgkin's disease. I've treated patients in that setting with BV and had long, durable remissions. So, yeah, and other settings as well.
All right, let's talk about mantle cell. So the two things that I thought were kind of hot topics that we definitely need to talk about. One, of course, we just talked about Hodgkin. But the other is the issue of BTK in mantle cell. There's not only do we have, I guess, the second generation agents, acalabrutinib, zanubrutinib, but more recently, we've got the approval of pirtobrutinib. So I'm really curious how you're thinking through that. We have a couple of cases, and then we'll talk a little bit about the data again. Here's Dr. Zanetta Lamar talking about a 58-year-old man.
58-year-old gentleman who was incidentally found to have mantle cell lymphoma after complications, falling a fall, and blunt force trauma, actually after an intoxicated episode. So he fell and had a hemothorax, and so CT surgery took him to surgery to evacuate the blood. They saw a pleural mass, biopsied it. I saw him immediately after he was diagnosed, but did a bone marrow biopsy on him, and it showed 75% involvement, actually, of a blastoid variant of mantle cell lymphoma. I saw information about the SHINE trial that looked at ibrutinib, bendamustine, and rituximab. How are you thinking about using this regimen?
Any other questions?
The question in mantle cell that is, to me, has always been a question in mantle cell is there a role for transplant? And also, how are you treating your younger patients? Are you still using the aggressive, intensive regimens for these patients? Many of my patients with mantle cell lymphoma are actually over 65, but when are you thinking about CAR T cell therapy? Are you thinking about this early?
So once I hear the word SHINE and triangle, I immediately get a headache trying to figure it out. I'm going to let you take a shot at explaining. A lot of people tried to explain it to me. We'll get into that as well as just the whole issue of BTK inhibitors. But anything you want to say about this case, and particularly the blastoid variant? Another thing we've heard about are people with P53. How do you approach those cases?
Well, yeah, she asked many questions. It's basically about how to treat all of mantle cell lymphoma. It's brought up a lot of issues. The blastoid variant, to me, is one of the most difficult questions of how to do that. I mean, the SHINE trial, you can either say that's positive or negative in the blastoid variant or in those P53 mutant patients, in the sense that it did improve upon things in that subgroup, the blastoid variants, but it didn't. But it wasn't a home run. It was just a very marginal improvement in that. And so for a while there, without really thinking about what to do, what I could do for that patient population, I've tried that in a few patients. The issue that comes up with that is, if your next therapy in a blastoid variant is CAR T cells, well, then you want to avoid bendamustine, because we know that bendamustine is a dramatically worsens our ability to treat patients with CAR T cells. The outcomes are much worse in patients who've been previously treated with bendamustine, at least within the last year. And so a lot of these blastoid variants are going to progress within a year. I mean, I think a reasonable option and off study would be is to try the combination of a BTK inhibitor and venetoclax. There are certainly trials looking at that, and we don't know the answer yet. But it's a desperate situation. If you didn't have a clinical trial, that's something I would do. She, I don't know. She also brought out some other questions, and if you want me to address them about where we're doing transplant these days, in the Triangle trial. I mean, I have rapidly adopted the outcomes of that study that showed that there really isn't an advantage of doing transplant over just incorporating a BTK inhibitor into chemotherapy and keeping patients on the BTK inhibitor post chemotherapy for a couple of years. And so I'm no longer transplanting patients with mantle cell lymphoma. Now, there's some point out that there may be some subgroups that comes out, some of these high-risk patient populations that might still benefit, but we haven't seen data yet to show us to continue to do that. So for the most part, I'm no longer doing transplant in patients with mantle cell lymphoma.
Was it the Triangle trial that got you to stop doing transplants?
It was. It absolutely was. If you can get the same outcome by just adding a BTK inhibitor to chemoimmunotherapy as you can by doing a transplant, and the transplant doesn't really add anything to the BTK inhibitor, then why do it? I mean, the bigger question to me comes about and is are you wedded to the R-CHOP, R-DHAP, the cytarabine-containing regimen as induction in that patient population? And I'm less convinced that that's true, but if you're sticking to the trial, you would want to use that regimen.
Interesting. Well, let's present another case and then we'll get back to SHINE and Triangle and also monotherapy. But one other thing I want to just ask you about, because we were chatting before we got started here and you said something to me I never heard before. Probably everybody else in the audience has heard it, but I never heard it before. So the first thing you mentioned to me was the toxicity of CAR T in mantle cell. And of course, as you mentioned, you know, it's Brexi, which is essentially axicell, which we know is more toxic, but it sounded like it was even more than that. Can you talk a little bit about this, what you were mentioning, that the things like CRS are more intense with mantle cell, and also whether or not bispecifics are going to end up coming in before or instead of CAR T?
Yeah, and that's right. I mean, patients who have a mantle cell lymphoma and get a CAR T cell, it's a much more difficult road. They have higher incidence of adverse events, much more CRS, there's neurotoxicity. Every patient that we take through it honestly seems like they develop a problem. And whether it's just the bulk of disease, the fact that they're very, you know, for lack of a better term, inflamed when they go into it, it's definitely a more difficult patient population. And I do think this is a great opportunity for the bispecifics to come into this setting. The data with glofitamab is excellent in mantle cell lymphoma and other diseases as well, but in mantle cell lymphoma, which I don't think we have any evidence that CAR T cells are curative, to me, the glofitamab is a natural place for that to go, and hopefully that will get a label in that setting in the not too distant future.
So Abdul in the chat room wants to know about rituximab maintenance after transplant. Of course, you said you stopped doing transplant, but he says, what about that? Or what about using a BTK as maintenance instead for people who still are doing transplant, or for you in general, are you using R maintenance?
Right. So I think that R maintenance, if you're doing a transplant, has been the standard of care. There's great data that shows that it, after transplant, it improves progression-free and survival and overall survival. We had a trial at SCRI looking at using acalabrutinib instead of rituximab maintenance after an autologous transplant. It was based on minimal residual disease, and we had to close it coming back from ASH because there wasn't patients that we were going to transplant anymore, and so we closed that just because of the changing treatment paradigms. But if someone was to get a transplant, I would definitely do rituximab maintenance. That said, in this era of COVID, I lost a number of patients. I mean, 4 or 5 patients getting rituximab maintenance after a transplant for mantle cell lymphoma who were in complete remission to COVID, and it's devastating.
Wow, that is terrible. Amani in the chat room wants to know about the potential role of transplant after CAR T in refractory disease.
In mantle cell lymphoma, I think the likelihood of you getting someone back into remission in order to go to a transplant, an autologous transplant at least, when I think that, you know, I would say the same thing for an allogeneic transplant, you have to be in remission. So the likelihood of getting someone into a remission after CAR T cell for mantle cell lymphoma, I think, is very, very small. You also have to have good hematopoiesis. And we know that there are many patients who are treated with CAR T cells have these persistent cytopenias that also might make it difficult to do a transplant, to collect the cells and so forth.
So let's hear about another mantle cell case, and then I want to pick your brain a little bit more about BTK and also which BTK. Here's Dr. Buffalino talking about a 56-year-old man.
He presented to his primary care doctor just about a month ago now with a new elbow mass. It was not painful, ended up seeing an orthopedic surgeon and underwent an MRI of the left arm that showed a 3.5 centimeter circumscribed mass in the tissue medial to the elbow. At that point, he underwent an excisional biopsy of the mass, and that was consistent with mantle cell lymphoma. We did a PET CT hoping it was maybe localized disease to the elbow, but unfortunately, he was found to have stage 4 disease. He has involvement in the neck, chest, abdomen, pelvis, and then sort of this area in the elbow. He is completely asymptomatic. He has an ECOG of 0. So I guess what I wanted to sort of discuss is initial or induction therapy in young patients who are healthy with newly diagnosed mantle cell lymphoma. And then my follow-up question to that is, what is the role of combining chemoimmunotherapy with the Bruton kinase inhibitors in the upfront setting?
And also your indication to treat mantle cell. This patient was asymptomatic. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can watch patients closely until they start to develop symptoms and then treat them. It sounds like this patient has classic mantle cell lymphoma rather than the indolent variant. Indolent variant is often with splenomegaly and high white count. This patient probably is classic. So you could watch it for a while. My guess is probably not going to watch for very long. And so I would also think it's also reasonable to start therapy soon. I have adopted, as we mentioned earlier, the triangle approach of giving chemoimmunotherapy followed by 2 years of maintenance with a BTK inhibitor, and also with rituximab in that patient population. And this patient is someone I would probably give them the regimen, even though I hate it, of the R-CHOP, R-DHAP regimen as it was done in triangle. For many other patients, older patients, I'm doing basically the same thing, but I'm using bendamustine and rituximab. And it's different, I think. It's really hard to reconcile those two trials with this trial with SHINE, where you gave the BTK inhibitor wherever. I'm really not doing that anymore. I'm really doing a couple years of therapy and hoping that's sufficient. And maybe you can use the BTK inhibitor later on if the patient progresses.
So in your older patients, you're using BR plus BTK?
So I'm using BR. It depends on how old they are. But if they're, 65 to 70, I'm using a very similar regimen, BR plus BTK inhibitor, but not doing like the SHINE study and giving it indefinitely. The problem with the SHINE data for me was, while you definitely is a positive trial and you improve progression-free survival, it's the amount of progression-free survival is about the same as you get if you did them sequentially rather than concurrently. And then you have all those years of acquired adverse events. And so I've sort of gotten away from that in that patient population. I also think it's very reasonable just to give the person BR plus, give them BR and then wait for them to progress and start them on a BTK inhibitor at that time. I mean, I don't know that we know one's better than the other. I'm just trying to reconcile these different data sets, which I think are very conflicting.
So when you do use BR plus BTK, which BTK?
So I don't use ibrutinib anymore. I either use acalabrutinib or zanubrutinib. I think most of the studies with zanubrutinib show a little bit more of neutropenia. So that'd be one reason why you wouldn't. On the other hand, I think the cardiovascular side effects are probably the best seen with zanubrutinib. And so I don't really have a one favorite BTK inhibitor. I'm willing to use either. I am using a little bit more zanubrutinib recently than I have been in the past. But I think honestly, either was fine.
So that brings us to this issue, which is a BTK monotherapy. Up to now, more commonly used in the second line setting. And of course, ibrutinib was actually, the approval was actually withdrawn fairly recently for mantle cell. Hassan in the chat room wants to know, what about using pirtobrutinib earlier upfront or instead of one of these two? But putting aside that issue, how do you decide in mantle cell between acala and zanu?
Yeah, I think they're more similar than they are dissimilar. Of course, if you extrapolate from the data in CLL, that there's an advantage, at least in CLL, in progression-free survival of zanu versus ibrutinib, but it wasn't a head-to-head comparison compared to acalabrutinib. I think the cardiovascular data looks really good with zanubrutinib as it does with acala. I really don't have a huge axe to grind about one versus the other. I am using more zanubrutinib recently than I am acalabrutinib, but that doesn't mean that acalabrutinib isn't a great drug. I'm very comfortable with my patients who are on it. You know, we've also looked at studies of looking at intolerance, right? And so we have a study of zanu after ibrutinib, and zanu was very well tolerated. Most of the adverse events that led to discontinuation of ibrutinib didn't reoccur with zanu, but if they did, at a lesser degree. But there's also another arm in that same trial where we're trying to recruit people that are intolerant of acalabrutinib and then go on to a zanubrutinib. And it turns out that's really hard to find. I mean, there aren't that many patients that are intolerant of acalabrutinib, and that trial has been very slow to accrue. I mean, that's sort of a backwards way of saying, I think they're both really, really well-tolerated drugs, and I think that our patients are in good hands with either of them.
What about the patient with hypertension or difficult-to-control hypertension? Any preference?
You know, perhaps that's an advantage for acalabrutinib. The zanubrutinib data maybe not quite as good in that setting. And maybe in that patient, acalabrutinib is an advantage there. Yeah.
Any comments about the new formulation of acalabrutinib? You know, I think it was met with a lot of happiness by patients and docs as well. What's it been like for you since this came out?
Oh, it's been so much better. I mean, the old preparation where you had to avoid proton pump inhibitors or H2 blockers was really a mess. I had this one patient who came in and told me, and I said, would you like me to switch you to this other formulation? He said, well, tell me about it. And I did. And then he said, well, this is a lifesaver for me because right now I have to have an interval of every 6 hours where I take a medicine to alternate my Pepcid versus the acalabrutinib. You know, he was an engineer. He's a fantastic guy, but he was taking it so to the letter of law that he was had to get up, set an alarm to take a medicine every 6 hours. So it was revolutionary for him to have that new formulation.
So pirtobrutinib, getting a lot of questions in the chat room about that. Now it's approved. I hope it gets approved for CLL soon. I can't believe it's not approved for CLL, but I don't know anything about the FDA. But anyhow, you've done work with this as well. As always, the pirtobrutinib, I love the pirtobrutinib waterfall plots, particularly when you see prior BTK. But we also, and also the safety profile being so positive. Interesting. Here's a trial comparing it to the other BTK, so we'll see what happens there. Any thoughts, though, about what comes first, pirtobrutinib or CAR-T, or maybe bispecific, if that we could?
Yeah, I think this is where it's going to be a little bit individualized. You know, you have an older patient in their 70s, which is a lot of our patients with mantle cell lymphoma, that you're not really so comfortable taking to a CAR T cell, then maybe that's where you would go to pirtobrutinib first rather than not trying to avoid the CAR T cell. On the other hand, a younger patient, you got someone in their 50s that that's already gone through one of the covalent bound BTK inhibitors. Maybe if you're going to change the natural history of the disease, maybe that's where you're going with with a CAR T cell. And I think the unanswered question is just what you brought up is was when we don't yet have them available, but a bispecific antibody such as glofitamab, I think that might really change the paradigm once again and do that. So I would tend to use pirtobrutinib in those older patients that you're afraid to have a very aggressive therapy for, maybe use a CAR T cell in those younger patients. Another place to do this is that, and we talked about how CAR T cells are difficult to give to patients who have with CAR T cells, maybe putting them onto pirtobrutinib to get disease control and then go to a CAR T cell. That might be a really great place to think about how to sequence these therapies.
Any thoughts about this study? I always love the R-squared upfront study. I still hear occasional cases where people do it in really older patients, et cetera. But the same group now added on Acala, which I thought was pretty cool. Any thoughts about that?
Well, I think it's a great study. I mean, you're adding again it's a less intense approach to the treatment of mantle cell lymphoma, getting out of our normal paradigms where we are using chemoimmunotherapy as the backbone of all the approaches. And so the data is immature yet, but it is very impressive so far. I think that only larger studies will really let us know whether that's the way to go, but I really like it.
And here's a SHINE-like study, but instead of ibrutinib, looking at acalabrutinib. I'm not sure exactly where there has been. And in this interesting trial in younger patients, again, looking at kind of a triangle type approach, but using acalabrutinib. Let's talk about follicular. I want to go through a few more cases here. We got two cases here to go through. The first is a 66-year-old man, a patient of Dr. Battinger.
I take care of a 66-year-old gentleman who has stage 3 follicular lymphoma that was incidentally discovered while he was admitted to the hospital for a stroke. While he was undergoing stroke workup, he had an MRI of the brain, and the MRI of the brain showed a 1.7 centimeter left parotid mass. He had a biopsy that confirmed his diagnosis of grade 3A follicular lymphoma. He had a staging PET CT scan that showed 3 sites of disease, the left parotid with an SUV max of 17. He had bilateral axillary adenopathy with lymph nodes measuring 3 centimeters. He also had this fairly large left inguinal lymph node that was 5.2 centimeters and pretty FDG avid with an SUV of 22.8. He actually has recovered very nicely from the stroke and walks more than I do, 15,000 steps a day. He has no constitutional complaints and he feels great. He does have some pretty sizable lymph nodes. He's not especially bothered by them, but I was wondering, he's sort of flirting with when to start therapy. And so I was just wondering if someone could comment on whether it's a good idea to start now or whether just to proceed with treatment only if he becomes more symptomatic.
Any thoughts?
So Neil, I missed, was this a grade 1-2 or a grade 3A follicular lymphoma?
Grade 3A.
Yeah. I mean, I think I would lean toward treating this patient. Those SUVs of 24 very bother me a lot. I know that she biopsied one. If there isn't a grade 3A is right on the edge, but 3B, which is considered a diffuse large cell lymphoma. I'm wondering whether this patient isn't in the process of transforming into a more aggressive lymphoma. I'm a big fan and supporter of bendamustine and rituximab. This is not somebody I would treat with BR. I would treat this patient with R-CHOP. Some of the trials, including the BRIGHT trial, that excluded these patients, these 3A patients, from the trial. And so I would probably move this patient along, treat him with R-CHOP.
Let's take a look at another case and maybe get your take in general about follicular lymphoma, some of the newer approaches. This is a 39-year-old woman, a patient of Dr. Morgenstein.
39-year-old woman who came to me after years of not having medical care, Spanish-speaking only. When you talked to her, she noticed lymphadenopathy for years. And it was a little hard to pin her down on how many years she actually had this. When I saw her, she had massive lymphadenopathy throughout all her lymph node stations, including one of the biggest epitrochlear lymph nodes that I've ever seen. Lymph node biopsy showed grade 1-2 follicular lymphoma. She's currently receiving rituximab, bendamustine. After cycle one, really just after a couple of weeks, she had prompt resolution of her lymphadenopathy. No evidence of transformation either on PET scan, on symptoms. So the question is, what is the best first-line treatment for follicular lymphoma? And particularly, what's the best anti-CD20 antibody? Is it obinutuzumab or rituximab? And what is the role and duration of maintenance rituximab?
And I should say that the epitrochlear node was 7 centimeters. Could you imagine that? 7 centimeters. Anyhow, any thoughts about his questions about obinutuzumab and upfront treatment? Actually, Muhabin in the chat room was talking about the 3A patient, said, what about R-squared? And I'd say, what about R-squared bispecific, I guess, is being looked at in trials. You know, any thoughts about these questions about upfront treatment?
Well, I mean, I think I still tend to use bendamustine and rituximab. I certainly think R-squared, we know that that's, you know, roughly equivalent. You could have used R-squared in this patient population. I tend to save R-squared for second-line therapy. I tend to use bendamustine and rituximab upfront. I still use rituximab, not obinutuzumab. I'm convinced that obinutuzumab is probably a better antibody, and it makes it's most apparent in, but I'm not so sure it's all that much of a better antibody in follicular lymphoma or lymphoma in general. And it probably does have more hematopoietic toxicity and other adverse events. And so I use 10-UDR. He also asked the question about maintenance. And here, you know, for many years, I used rituximab maintenance in patients that we know that improves progression-free survival, and hoping that it would ultimately translate into an overall survival advantage. And that overall survival advantage has never materialized. And so, even before COVID, I had really had gotten away from using rituximab maintenance in patients with follicular lymphoma based on that. And then when COVID came in, I definitely have not been using it because of the increased risk for patients.
So yeah, it wasn't that long ago when we were doing CME on follicular lymphoma, all we had to talk about was rituximab maintenance. It was pretty boring, but now not even close to being boring. Any comments on tazemetostat and EZH2 assays?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's probably that if you find the mutation, that those patients probably have a higher chance of responding and maybe a little bit more durable response. But it also works in patients that are EZH2 germline or normal. And so, and often it's difficult to find the sample unless you're doing a fresh biopsy, sending it off, getting it done. And so it's almost easier just to do an in vivo test and give the patient tazemetostat and see whether they respond. There's such a low adverse event profile. I think there's very little to be lost if you're considering that patient in, you know, third line therapy.
What about the trials? I think there's some trials looking at bispecifics and R squared up front. Any thoughts about that strategy?
Yeah, there sure is. There's a large randomized phase 3 trial looking at that R squared backbone and adding tazemetostat. And I think it's a fantastic trial. We have it open in a number of our centers, and I know it's opened throughout this country. And I think it, you know, that R squared backbone is such a good backbone to combine things. There are also trials in design and they're opening using R squared, as you mentioned earlier, plus bispecific. So a lot of people are trying to hitch their wagon to that backbone, and for good reason.
Incidentally, I'm still flashing back on that thing where you mentioned the toxicity of CAR T in mantle cell. Do you see more toxicity from bispecifics in mantle cell?
I don't know yet, honestly. I think the jury's still out there. The N is relatively small, but I would expect it wouldn't surprise me if there was a more CRS in that patient population as well.
So Hassan in the chat room asked a really great question, which is mosunetuzumab now approved. NFL, do you use it before or after tazemetostat? You were telling me there's a trial looking at it up front.
Yeah, there is. The sponsor has a trial open, and we have it open within Sarah Cannon Research Institute. We have it open locally in Nashville as well. It is a frontline trial, all outpatient, mosunetuzumab, and of course, it's incredibly popular, right? I mean, you ask your patient, do you want immunotherapy? Do you want chemotherapy? And everyone says, I want immunotherapy. It's for a fixed duration of a year. It is really one of the fast accruing trials I've done in many, many years. And so far, the adverse event profile has been fine. We really haven't seen much in the way of need for hospitalization for CRS events.
Anything you can say in terms of observations in any of your patients in terms of response? I would assume they're responding.
Yeah, they are. I mean, I think we presented data at Lugano with just a handful of patients, mostly just trying to show that it's practical. This can be done in the community. There are sites all over the country, Tennessee, Alaska, every place that are doing this. And so it's a very feasible approach. The numbers are too small for me to say that the response rate, but you'd have to expect it to be pretty high in this patient population.
So Paramavir in the chat room wants to know about CRS and neurotoxicity with mosunetuzumab. And also, can you talk a little bit about the schedule and the methods of administration and sort of how it is to give the drug?
Right. So I should have mentioned in that trial that we are doing it as a sub-Q formulation. Right now, it's still intravenous, that the FDA approach, but we'll see sub-Q administration of mosun hopefully within the next couple of years. But of course, you do in the first cycle, you do stepped up dosing. You're dose escalating it up until you get to the target dose. And then in subsequent doses, patients all get the target dose. And really after the first cycle, there's negligible amount of CRS. To remind everybody, right, if we grade it, grade 1 or 2, there's very, very little grade 3 CRS. Most of this is grade 1 CRS. And of course, grade 1 CRS is a fever, right? So if you're giving someone rituximab, you wouldn't call it CRS. You would just call it an infusion-related fever. There's very little. There is some grade 2, which is hypotension requiring fluids but not requiring pressors, and that's the vast majority of the CRS events that are seen with mosun. There's almost no, close to zero neurotoxicity. If you look at the ICANS that we associate with CAR T cells, there's maybe 1 or 2 patients on these trials that could get it, and but in reality, in practice, there's close to zero neurotoxicity that we see with CAR T cells. This is not different, and this is a different profile, right, than you see with the other bispecifics. This is different than we see with glofitamab, with epcoritamab. I mean, those bispecifics still, most patients will require a hospitalization for observation at the target dose to make sure they don't have these events. There are a lot of trials going on trying to fix that, and I'm sure that's coming, right? You think about it. We now do CAR T cells as an outpatient. I'm sure that we're going to be doing other bispecifics as an outpatient. But today, those bispecifics are given, have to have a hospitalization for observation.
Getting back to mosunetuzumab, though, I mean, from your perspective, at least theoretically, could you see community-based general medical oncologists administering from the beginning? Or do you think it would really require tertiary starting it?
For mosun, no. I mean, these are all my partners within Tennessee Oncology. I think we treated maybe 45 people in the central facility, but in the community offices throughout Middle Tennessee. So yeah, no, I think it's absolutely. This is something that can be done within the average community physician's office.
Another question from the chat room. In general, is CRS related to bulk of disease?
I'm not so, and again, I think that might vary from one product to the next, but not that I know of per se that's so clear cut that there's a difference with the bulk of disease.
You kind of like not like TLS. Here's an oldie but goodie. Rituximab single agent versus BR.
Well, I mean, I think it's a different patient, right? There are some very durable remissions with single agent rituximab. I remember the old Swiss cooperative group trial. There are people that were on remissions for, you know, 7 years in a minority of the patient population. To me, it's a little bit a different group of patients. That's an older patient that you're worried about giving them standard, you know, chemoimmunotherapy to.
All right, let's finish out with diffuse large B-cell. We have a couple of cases here. Another FCS doc, Dr. Zafar, you probably know him, 82-year-old man with a lot of comorbidities. And because of that, he gets a frontline RGCVP, but has progressive disease. Here's Dr. Zafar.
82-year-old retired Wisconsin farmer, so he thinks he's a tough guy. But, you know, he's got congestive heart failure, coronary artery disease, AFib on anticoagulation, neuropathy. You know, he's still independent, mentally very strong, but physically okay.
Any questions about this case?
Is there any specific cutoff for CAR T? I talked to him about that, and he wants to learn more about it. So he's going to meet in Tampa with someone about CAR T. But, you know, that requires a lot of commitment. Would age be a problem? Would some of his comorbidities be a problem? Would timing be a problem because he is progressing? And how do we bridge him? Because some studies did not do bridging, some did bridging. And what do we use? I mean, we can start Taflin. I know some centers do bridging with polatuzumab-based treatment, and then they move on to CAR T. But this would be somebody that I would be interested to hear more about.
Yeah, interesting. Maybe bispecifics. Any thoughts about this case?
Well, he brought up a lot of different issues. First of all, I don't think there's a age cutoff per se for CAR T cells, but all the comorbidities here make me think that this person's not a candidate. And most notably, the cardiac issues, including the CHF. And this is probably, it's a risk-benefit analysis. And you have to say, what's the upside for this patient with all these comorbidities versus the downside? I mean, he could get hurt pretty badly with CAR T cells. And so, you know, I'm not so sure this patient would survive it if he got into, if he had to go to the ICU. But with regard to some of the other issues, bridging therapy, my favorite bridging therapy for someone that I am taking to CAR T cells is R-polatuzumab without the bendamustine. Some people consider therapy before we heart cells as bridging, and some people, you know, afterwards. You definitely don't want to give anything. If you can avoid any therapy before we harvest the T cells, you're better off, right? Because then those cells become less fit, and there's reason to believe that the efficacy goes down. We know from certain studies that those patients who require bridging either before or after, I mean, in between the time you've harvested T cells and the received treatment, the outcomes are inferior. But that's a little bit of a chicken the egg thing. That probably has to do with the fact that those patients were just sicker and required therapy and couldn't be maintained with steroids while the CAR T cell was being manufactured. So I would avoid Tafalen in a patient that I was taking to CAR T cells, at least before. The reason I say that is I'm not sure about CD19 therapies in someone you're about to give CAR T cells. If they got CD19 a couple of cycles, a couple of therapies before, well, I'm not so worried about it. But then immediately prior to receiving CAR T cells, I would probably avoid CD19 based therapy. We don't know about giving the bispecifics. And so you wonder whether that's a new therapy that could be given for this patient population. They're CD20. CAR T cells are targeting CD19. Theoretically, that's not an issue. I don't know if there's any issue with increased toxicity afterwards with giving the CAR T cells. It's a really important question that's not answered yet. We do know that bispecific antibodies work after somebody has relapsed after a CAR T cell, and there's efficacy there.
If he's not going to go to CAR T, what would you be thinking about?
So I would think long and hard about either using epcoritamab, but of course that's approved for third line, not second line. So that's a little bit of a handicap. the BR Pola regimen is also proved as third line, not as second line. That said, I think it's been around a lot longer, and I'm not sure that we would get as much pushback in that setting. If I were to, that would be my therapy of choice. Probably, I would probably drop out or dramatically reduce the dose of bendamustine in that patient.
Dilip in the chat room wants to know what geriatric evaluation you do for 70-plus-year-old patients.
Gosh, I don't have a formal geriatric evaluation. Probably should, but I don't have it. It's more of an eyeball test and their performance status. And, you know, you hear about some people just how fast it takes them to walk, you know, 10 yards, their ability to get out of a chair, things like that. It's more of an eyeball test and some formal test that I put people through.
Yeah, I had a feeling you were going to be an eyeball person. All right, let's hear one more case. There's another case from Dr. Lamar, a 75-year-old man.
This is my 75-year-old contractor who developed rapidly progressing proptosis of the left eye. He had an MRI that showed a 5.4 centimeter mass extending from the sinus, you know, causing his eye to bulge out. He went to the ophthalmologist, had a biopsy performed, and that confirmed diffuse large B-cell lymphoma with double protein expression, but there was no evidence of double hit. His IPI score was 2. He was initially treated with R-mini-CHOP, and then I saw him, and I actually gave him full-dose R-CHOP, and then systemic methotrexate for CNS prophylaxis, and he is currently in a complete response.
So he was started out on treatment by another doc?
Right.
And they decided that they were concerned about giving him full dose R-CHOP just because he was 75 or some other reason?
Yes. So they were concerned about giving him full dose R-CHOP because of his age.
But otherwise, he was a healthy 75-year-old?
Yeah. He was building houses.
Wow.
He said, I was building houses before my eye came out.
Wow. So what are the questions you'd like to hear discussed?
So patients with an IPI score of 2 or higher, are you automatically incorporating polatuzumab?
Any thoughts about this case? Have you seen anything like this in the eye, incidentally?
Yes, and then also the eye and the sinuses, it's relatively, it's a not uncommon presentation. The eye itself, a little bit unusual, but for a large cell, we see many other lymphomas, mantle cell lymphoma, follicular lymphoma, marginal zone lymphoma, we see in the eye like that. To her question, I generally have been adding now using the polatuzumab regimen, the Polarix regimen for patients with IPI 2 and higher. And again, there's not a survival advantage, and is it wrong not to do it? Probably not, but I don't see the downside of doing that. There really isn't an worsening of adverse event profile in that patient population.
So also want to ask you, we were talking about BTK a lot before, and I'm curious about your thoughts in terms of BTK in diffuse large B-cell. We see this phase 3 study that's ongoing, adding in a BTK inhibitor, acalabrutinib, to R-CHOP in untreated non-germinal disease. Any comments on that strategy and where you think it's heading? Any comments?
Well, there was a study with ibrutinib that showed that in a younger patient pop, it was a post hoc analysis, but in patients with non-GCB patients, there was a benefit in those patients who received ibrutinib in younger non-GCB patients, but it never got approved based on that. So I think it's a reasonable study and hypothesis. My problem with this whole approach is that we now have the bar has been moved. We now have the Pola-R CHIP regimen that's improved things, and this is such a small subgroup of patients. Is it really the study might be positive, but in the end, is it really going to be used when we have these other regimens that are now available?
So another question in the chat room is about the CNS maintenance she elected to give. Do you agree with that? And how do you do CNS maintenance?
Yeah, so prophylaxis of the central nervous system, I think it was probably a good idea because it was looked to me on that MRI just briefly, but it looked like it was sort of trapping up the optic nerve. And I think there was a high risk for central nervous system involvement. I think I definitely would do it. We use high-dose methotrexate. There's now a national shortage of methotrexate, and so it's a real problem getting our patients treated, but we would use high-dose methotrexate. There was a study that was presented that showed in the past I would incorporate it with on day eight of an RCHOP-like regimen, just admit them for the high-dose methotrexate. There was a study that showed that you can do this after the chemotherapy is completed, and the outcome was very similar. So for by and large, when we have methotrexate, I try not to do the intrathecal anymore because I think there's better biodistribution with the high-dose intravenous methotrexate.
And here's another study looking at BTK acalabrutinib, and this with R mini chop, which is interesting. She was asking about. All right, one final quick case from the chat room. I can't resist. This is like an elevator case. You get on with the 12th floor, and the person's next to you. And as you're going down, they go, "This is venue. I have a patient with a 15 centimeter liver mass, diffuse large B cell lymphoma, ABC, not double hit. Any thoughts?"
Yeah, I mean, I think you just treat this like you would treat anybody else. This is someone I would definitely use the Polarix regimen in the polatuzumab R-CHIP regimen for that patient.
Interesting. So thanks so much, Dr. Flynn. It was a pleasure working with you today. Audience, thank you for attending. Come on back Wednesday, June 28th, when you hear Dr. Monk and Powell have to say about the RUBY and NRG study and where things are right now in first-line therapy. Are you going to add an IO then or wait for second line? Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Ian.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.